Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And I'm Dr. Lisa, and I give a shit. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm here. I'm here with my guest, my spectacular guest, Indira Cesarine. Did I say your name right?
Yes.
Okay. Your last name. Your first name I knew. But anyway, so she's an incredible artist and gallerist and like... We're going to get to this in a minute, but I just want to let you know that, you know what I wanted to tell you? Honestly, guys, it took me 2 weeks to recover from Thanksgiving. I was really depressed until like yesterday, and I can't believe it. And I was really upset with my show last week. You know, my husband was on, and it was like one of the worst shows ever. I got to tell you, I don't know why. I think because I committed to play this 5 minute song up front, and then I got the sexuality of the guy wrong, and I knew the girl, see, but you know what? I have the same problem with my cat and my dog. I never get their sexuality right either. So it's not personal. I'm just a crazy person. So anyway, yeah, so that got it off to a rough start. But anyway, so I'm feeling better now. And I just wanted to let you guys know that, you know, holidays are rough. Holidays are rough. So drink a lot. Go to a lot of parties and get really wasted, which is great advice, right? Especially from a fake shrink. Thanks a lot for listening. So here's the deal. I got to get this out right now. We're having a really big fundraising guy. Guys, we're having a really big fundraising push because we may not have money to operate. And we have 70 shows. We're doing so much. We're freeform community radio, and it's a really important mission that we're all on. And we think raising money should be fun. Don't you? It's better than working. No. We're turning 5 years old, and we need to raise $25,000 in order to keep going. We're offering a trivia quiz. The top five scorers will win a limited edition 5 year anniversary RBT shirt. And you can also dial 718-673-8201 and leave a message letting us know why you love RFB or wish us a happy birthday. We may play your message on the air, which would be really exciting. And then you can tell your mom, and it'll make your holidays, and then you won't have to go into a deep, dark hole like I just am crawling out of. All right. So I'm here looking at the lovely, fabulous, smart, inspiring Indira Cesarine. How did that make you feel that I said all that? She shifted her eyes. Yeah, I know. But whatever. But so here's the thing. I'm going to call Indira an overachiever. And the reason I'm saying this is because if I don't call her that, you will feel like she's going to make you feel like a lazy ass. Okay. She is able to accomplish more than any normal human. And I'm not sure why and how. And I'm going to find out now. The other thing is that I was asking her before we started, and she doesn't really have a staff. She has some interns and stuff. So she's really doing this all herself. So I'm going to just list kind of what she does. I'm going to say achievements, but it's really just more practices. And then she's going to tell you a little bit. She's going to color it in for you. Okay. So first of all, she's an artist, a multimedia artist. She's, you know, shown a billion places, the press, the whole thing. You can go to IndiraCesarine.com, and it's all posted on my Facebook page today, and find out more about her. But besides that, so she's a multidisciplinary artist, and her work has been exhibited internationally, including the Met, all right? Then, on top of that, she is the director of her own gallery, The Untitled Art Space. She's the editor-in-chief of The Untitled Magazine. This is so exhausting, even just talking about this. She continues to contribute as a photographer and journalist besides overseeing the publication. And then on top of that, she has The Untitled Boutique, an online fashion real estate real retail site. Closed, not housing. Closed, folks. Untitled Productions, an event production company, and the art gallery and all that. And there's also, and before I turn it over to her, I just want to make a pitch about the Body Beautiful show, which is at the gallery now. The gallery is at 45 Lisbon Art Street, and it's a really great show with a lot of all sorts of various naked women, including me. I'm naked in it. And you should go see that. And there's an artist talk on Saturday. I'll be there between 2 and 5. So welcome, Indira. It's great to see you. Thanks for coming in. So give us like a broad strokes thing about first your art and then about all your businesses. How's that? Go.
I mean, that's
a little closer to the mic.
Okay, that's not an easy endeavor. I'll put it in a nutshell. I actually have worked as an artist and photographer pretty much my whole life. I had my first solo show at 16. I studied art history and feminism at Columbia University in the city. I moved to Paris and London right after college and worked full-time as a photographer for 15 years and was exhibiting my artwork at the same time. After now almost two decades of focusing just on my own work, I moved back to New York and I launched the Untitled magazine because I really wanted to get into collaborations with other artists and expand my repertoire. And I launched Untitled magazine about 10, 12 years ago. 5 years ago, I launched the Untitled Space Gallery. The art gallery is actually located in what used to be my photography studio. So a lot of people are not aware of that. But I converted my own personal art studio into the art gallery because it's a storefront space located in North Tribeca. And I just felt like it wasn't reaching its potential, just being used for my office and art studio, and that I could open it up, invite other artists to exhibit their work, expand my programming to help, you know, women in art. You know, one thing led to the other. It really blew up. The production company equally kind of just happened by the wayside of having the magazine, the gallery, you start producing events, you know, so it made sense to have some clients occasionally throw some bones at us with some, you know, productions, cocktails, what have you. We've had events for everyone from Richard Branson to Tommy Hilfiger at the gallery, and they always have a nice little budget. So that helps run my operation costs.
Whoa. See, you better be lying down when you hear all this, because that's incredible. And you seem like really natural at it. Like you seem like your vision for whatever you're doing seems to really click. You know, I mean, you work hard and stuff, but you're also, you know, able to just by nature of the quality and the interest, you know, the thinking behind the work, or whatever it is that you're doing, to actually draw people in, which is a gift, really. I mean, I mean, not that you don't work hard. You know, I mean, we're all about that, but it's also you're able to communicate very, very well and naturally through all your efforts, not just yourself.
Yeah, I feel like when I first launched the magazine, for example, that was a massive extension of my previous career, sort of focusing full-time. My main emphasis in photography, I was making my income as a fashion and beauty photographer. So I was shooting for everyone from British Vogue to, you know, French Vogue, Glamour, Dior, Kenzo, like all those sort of luxury brands and magazines, which is a very intense career, by the way.
I can't imagine.
I think a lot of people they underestimate, like, what is involved with working full time as a photographer. But when I had agents in New York, Paris, London, Milan, mm-hmm. Los Angeles, and Sydney, I was traveling in a different country, probably three different countries a week, living out of a suitcase. I had apartments in New York, London, and Paris to manage my career because I needed a place to sleep. I didn't have time to book hotels. It was just like fly in, fly out, shoot, mm-hmm. move. And you would be working on the plane. You would be constantly producing, casting, editing, working on the next job. There was a constant flow. I did that for 15 years.
Wow.
And I got to that point where I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore, because I also felt like there was a certain amount of creativity that I wasn't able to achieve. Yeah,
right.
I felt like, in the beginning, when I started out, it was super creative. And as it evolved, it became more and more like what the clients wanted, because I was getting into much bigger, higher caliber mm-hmm. productions. Sure. And the more money you get paid, the more demands mm-hmm. they put mm-hmm. on you. So it got to that stage where I was like, okay, I want to just totally turn this around and focus on my own thing. And I launched my own magazine and had an amazing amount of support with other artists that wanted mm-hmm. to come on board, mm-hmm. photographers, stylists, writers mm-hmm. that wanted to come and collaborate, because they wanted that also creative space where they could say and do what they want, create really interesting, beautiful productions mm-hmm. without limitations of clients breathing down their neck saying, no, it has to be like this.
Right. Creative freedom. So here's one of the things that I find fascinating about you that, guys, I want to get to the bottom of this. Let's see. Is that I'm going to just talk about you in the third, talk about you like you're not here. Okay. Dear, okay. So, cause I'm talking to these guys here, you guys at home or wherever you are. So anyway, the thing about Indira, if you don't know her or haven't, go look it up. Okay. Look at the pictures. She is, a powerhouse, but she's also like a very beautiful, glamorous, very well put together person, female. And, in the stereotype, I think that she's an incredible champion of women. And the stereotype of, and I think I've said this to you before, Indira, did I say something like this to you before? I'm afraid she's.
I'm not sure what you're going to say.
Okay, so maybe I'm going to insult her. No, I hope not. I hope not. No, but okay, so here's a little counter transference. She's very like together and authoritative. And I am probably a little intimidated. And so I just am afraid I'm going to project that counter transference onto you. So that's about my neuroses, not you. Okay, we got that out. So here's the thing, is that in my experience, the stereotype that I have in my head of women that are always champion other women are just not the stereotype of what Indira is. To me, Indira makes it such a priority. All the things she does is really to champion other women. At the same time, as a woman herself, she is somebody that could be getting all that attention and all that, you know, investment, that time, energy coming back to her. But she is incredibly driven about sharing it. And I can tell you, even in this show, I'm in this group show. She put me in the show. I'm really thrilled to be in it. I really respect the gallery and the work that she shows and the work that she makes. And I'm very excited about the piece I have in it. And anyway, she's also very fair about giving credit to all the artists, which I find really, really unusual. I mean, usually they highlight like the bigger seller or the person who's more well known, or a couple of people or something like that. And I've noticed in all the press about the article I'm in, it's very fair. Like, I can't imagine anybody reading it and think, oh, she liked her better. And so anyway, is my assessment of you making any sense, Indira?
It is, actually.
I mean, good.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, an interesting little story. When I first launched the gallery, we were working on this really big exhibit, which you may have heard of, Uprise Angry Women.
Yeah.
And I was approached by a writer who I will not name, who was writing for Forbes. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to do a piece on the exhibit and the show. And they wanted to interview me. And they wanted to interview one of the 80 artists featured in the exhibit aside from me. Mm-hmm. And then they wanted to do a photo shoot of the two of us together.
Ooh.
And this was at Forbes. So I'm like, I literally turned it down, and people were shocked that I turned down, you know, Forbes magazine coverage on the exhibit. But I said, I am not comfortable with having everything be about me and one artist when this is a group show of 80 artists. Like, that's just not okay. I'm not going to do it.
See what I'm saying? See what I'm saying, folks? It's unheard of, right? Would you be that generous? I don't think you would. No, but I mean, that's really great. And the thing is, the funny thing about you, Indira, is that if you don't, like, just on the most superficial level, I think if people get to know you, and I don't really know you that well, I'm getting to know you. I'm getting to know you right now, but I bet people are surprised by that. It's a disconnect for a lot of people, I would guess. Do you get feedback like that?
A disconnect in what way?
Like you walk into this fabulous gallery and there's this like fat, I mean, you know, you are, she could be a model. Did you ever model?
I did briefly. Like,
yeah,
kind
you
of
could
in
be
college.
A model. She could be a model. So she looks like a model, but she also has great taste, and you also have great taste, but you're also very polished, which is just naturally, you know, my mother never wore makeup and I'm a slob. That's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, I'm not naturally that way. You are naturally that way. You look like, you know, you are a CEO. But anyway, so I think that when people just put you in the camp of, you know, like a powerful businesswoman, and there's a lot of empathy and sympathy and stuff that is forefront, seems forefront to you. And I just don't think that people assume that. They think that you're tough, maybe a killer or aggressive or, and, you know, out for yourself. Do you think that's true? Do you ever get any of that feedback?
Listen, I get a lot of course, negative feedback. And I think often people read me the wrong way.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Because they see how I look and they judge the book, the cover of the book versus like really trying to understand who I am, what I've been through, what I've done so far.
Right.
So, like the decades of time I devoted to my career before like sharing it with other people. And the, you know, in the sense of opening a gallery, like it's really hard to run an art gallery.
It's beyond me.
Like representing and exhibiting all these other artists instead of focusing on my own work.
Oh,
it's actually constantly a challenge for me to be
crazy.
Like mentally sort of like, why? Sometimes I wake up, I'm like, why am I doing this again? Somebody remind me why I took on all this extra work when I could just be focusing on my own artwork and probably be a lot happier. But then I think, well, you know, I actually really enjoy exhibiting other artists and I really enjoy having those opportunities available to them. And I think that it's a, you know, if I can do both, isn't that even better? Like, I feel like I like to give back. I like to constantly push myself to learn more. And I think you learn more by engaging and collaborating with other people. If it's all very insular and only about yourself, you're holding yourself back too.
Right. Yeah, you get a lot. You are able to get a lot out of it. But see, this is what makes me mad, and actually a challenge to me personally, in that we see a polished, you know, not just beautiful, but you know, beautiful and you know, powerful looking in that way of like, you know, she could be dating a president of a bank or something. Look, whatever that is. I don't know how to put that exactly into words, but that thing, whatever that is. And then we don't see that as a woman who is, whose main focus is to help other women. And that's a problem. I think that's a problem so in other words, I think you should be able to project glamour and all and, you know, power and still be and not be assumed that you're, you know, a killer.
Well, I think there's a lot of double standards and that's one of the things that I really work on closely with my own artwork, as well as the exhibits that I curate, is really addressing the double standards that we like deal with on a day-to-day basis, whether it's based on looks or beauty standards or based on gender, you know, there's so many double standards that women are constantly facing. And beauty has always been one of those stereotypes that if a person looks or dresses a certain way, people make assumptions about them. I come from working for over 15 years between London and Paris and Milan in the fashion industry. So yes, I do have a more sophisticated look than maybe the average artist or, you know, art curator, because that wasn't my career for the first. I came from a different world.
Also want to point out that you've also been, you know, you've gotten makeup tips and fashion tips from like experts, top experts. You have training.
Yeah, no, I was working with the top makeup artist in the world every day.
Anybody with that amount of training and real life experience, like I would probably I'd probably be great at makeup too.
Well, but, I mean, when you're, you know, just shoot campaigns for like L'Oreal and like, I mean, at the end of the day,
this stuff.
You can't really walk away like working on a daily basis in the fashion and beauty industry for like over 15 years and not take away some component of like, actually knowing how to put yourself together. And I personally think that, I don't even make a huge effort. My morning routine is literally like 5 minutes. I wake up and I put on my black eyeliner and I'm done. Like,
no,
like
actually,
the,
I think you came in for the radio show and she's pretty barefaced, folks. You didn't go to a lot. I mean, you look great, but you didn't go to a lot of trouble, which, I mean, I was kind of curious how you were going to present, but that's how she presented. But here's something I want to talk about too, is with your work and with the work that you curate, it is almost, I would say, most of the work deals with the female body.
Yes.
Right? And so what is your, I want to hear you verbalize actually what your interest is in the body, the female body, and about the aesthetics of the female body, because I think that's a big part of your work.
Absolutely.
And I think your work, your personal work and your curating work hand in hand, right?
Yes, very much so. I think my curatorial is kind of an extension of what personally interests me as an artist.
So what are the messages that you want to convey about the female body?
I mean, you know, to be honest with you, I think a lot of it draws back to even my most early interest in education. You know, when I was a child, I was very interested in feminism and studied art history. And I have a triple major from Columbia in art history, women's studies, and French literature. Mm-hmm. But women's studies was always a huge, like, interest to me.
What do you think drew you to that interest in women's?
Long story short,
my
mother is a lawyer. She is a human rights lawyer. And she was one of the only women to graduate University of Chicago Law School in 1959. She was the editor-in-chief of the Chicago Law Review when she was at law school. She was a National Merit Scholar. She was basically like an insane, like, genius fireball of a intelligent person, right? And she happened to have 5 children, of which I am the youngest. She worked throughout my childhood and worked for Dianne Feinstein to run her campaign for governor. Later open her own law firm in Sacramento, California. She worked with my dad like my whole career. They had a business together as a kid. And then
what did they do?
So my father had like a variety of different businesses that they set up together. She was a general counsel and oversaw the, you know, sort of legalities of the business. And he oversaw the sort of business thing. They had in the auto industry and real estate industry. And, you know, they had a multitude of different sort of interests.
Kind of like a bigger version, a more profitable version of what you're doing.
Yeah. No, I mean, they were in like 5 states.
Now I
like
see
what,
it.
You know, it was a pretty big
with
production.
With 5 kids.
Yes. Yeah, so
Iowa.
So
right?
I was born in Iowa, and my parents retired. My father retired when he was 50.
Wow.
He was just too overwhelmed, like too much work on his plate, kind of burnt out, and decided to retire. And my mother decided to open her own law firm when they retired. So he basically became a house husband, and she went to work like to do her own thing because it was her dream to always have her own firm. But anyway, having that female role model in my life since I was a baby, and seeing my mother sort of, and what she went through and the double standards that I also saw happening even at home. Growing up, et cetera. I don't know. I was just very, very sensitive to a lot of these issues as a child and very drawn to women's studies, to body politics. And one thing that I haven't shared often, but I have mentioned in a few previous interviews. So my mother was an orphan and her mother died of an abortion, which is like a big deal.
Wow.
Blood poisoning due to an abortion. It was illegal. She was unfortunately a victim of blood poisoning. So my mother was orphaned at the age of 11 because her father had already passed. So she was literally like this, you know, overcame so many obstacles to do what she did. And also having that legacy of having a grandmother who died from the politics of this country and abortion being illegal and a woman not being able to make those choices for herself, you know, so
that's really in your, so
this is in my DNA. That,
it's baked in there.
It's in my DNA.
Okay. Well, that makes, that's starting to clear. That's starting to make sense. What happened to your mother? Was she brought up by relatives or?
She was brought up by relatives. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But she pretty much just focused on studying and getting a scholarship, and she was an all scholarship student too. You know.
Are there other, you have four siblings, are there other girls in your family?
I have one older sister.
And is she like that? Is she like you? Is she like...
You know, my sister, she's, we're very different. She lives in LA. She's a dancer, classical dancer. She does, very, very different approach. She actually is an anti-feminist. She's not really into women's rights. Mm-hmm. She thinks that if feminism has been set up to just make women be slaves to the job.
Oh, well, and I'd like to believe that. That sounds good to me. Bill, I'm never working again. So, you're on your own.
Hey, right. So we're complete opposites.
So how were you brought up? Like, what was your dad like? Like, what was the dynamics of male, female? So you had three brothers, which would mean four guys and three chicks.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that like? What was your dad like?
I think that this is one of the reasons also why I was just very driven towards feminism from a young age. Is my father was very conservative, Catholic, sort of, you know, Austrian, Scandinavian background. And he grew up on like a ranch and had these very traditional notions of gender roles and like the woman's place. And even though my mother was a lawyer, he expected her to oversee all the traditional domestic duties in the home. And that used to infuriate me as a child. I used to be frustrated to see my mother who's a lawyer working so hard side by side, running business with my dad, but yet she'd have to go home and wash the dishes or clean up. And that pissed me off. I was like, that's so unfair. Mm-hmm. So I think from as a really young age, I was very angry at my father for being such a sexist. Yeah. And I got over that eventually. When he became a house husband, he actually totally turned the switch and became a much nicer man. And we became friends like later on in life. But as a kid, you know, that was a big issue.
Did you say things or was it apparent?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I applied to go to boarding school at 13 and moved out of the home at 14 to go to boarding school.
Really?
Because I didn't want to live there.
Really? Because of that dynamic?
Because I was not comfortable being in that environment.
What about your mother? Did you feel like your mother was letting your dad, she didn't stand up to your dad or something like that? Like, were you mad at her?
She's very in love with him. And I think that she equally grew up in the 50s. I mean, where that was like how it was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like, you know, she was like a pioneer in, with regards to like her education and her career choices. And she always said to me, oh, she appreciated the fact that her father let her have a job and let her be a lawyer and let her, because at the end of the day, a lot of the other men that she met when she was in law school expected her to just be a housewife and have babies, which was the expectation of that generation.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, but also you have to give that generation some, a tribute. Some of it to happen.
Yeah, it's cultural brainwashing.
But also, I mean, you were born in Iowa. Is your family from the Midwest?
No, my mother's from Texas and my father was from South Dakota. So I think Iowa just had a lot of tax incentives to set up their business there.
Well, that's not that far. So do you think, like, they weren't in where were you all living? Were you living in a... you know, in an unsophisticated, unevolved environment, like just
Oh, no. Des Moines, where we grew up.
Des Moines
is the capital city.
Oh, that's a normal
place. The capital city. We had, our art center was designed by I.M. Pei. I mean, they had a huge art and cultural, you know, we go to the, you know, we were constantly sort of very culturally engaged and went to very good schools. And it's a very good lifestyle you know, areas.
Oh, okay.
We weren't like lacking, like, you know, we weren't living out in the farmland or anything.
Yeah,
we were living in a city.
Yeah. So that's no excuse then.
I mean, I think you have to remember, like, even in the Midwest in general, probably even now, people have very traditional roles compared to, like, New York. Mm-hmm. I mean, we live in a bubble in New York City. Like, people mm-hmm. assume that everybody's this forward-thinking as people in Brooklyn and Manhattan, mm-hmm. but you know what? They're not. And if you go today and drive out to the Midwest, you're going to see that there's a lot of people who still function with very traditional gender roles and stereotypes and, you know, or is still living that sort of picket fence reality.
Yeah. And I think it's also, I mean, I think it's an excellent point. I think it's really important that we all in our little bubble here remember that, because that is a lot of the world that we're, that's the world we're in. And if we don't learn how to communicate and get along with these people and share with them, like, it's not good. Not good for anybody. So I think it's really important that we remember that we are not the center of the world. There are all sorts of people with all sorts. There's so many good people with so many ideas that are not in agreement with ours.
Well, I mean, look, Trump would not have been elected if, like, the rest of America was not very different from, like, New York.
Right.
You know,
but people can't imagine it. And we're not really asked. We're all in our own bubble. Get out of your bubble.
I actually feel very blessed that I had that upbringing in Iowa, because I think I've seen a very different reality in the United States.
Right.
Having come from mm-hmm. this type of community and background mm-hmm. and lived there until I was 14 mm-hmm. years old. And then having lived in New York City and gone to, you know, college in New York and then moved to Europe. I mean, I've kind of lived around the world. And traveled all over the world. And I feel like I think that's one thing. It's just so important to push yourself to travel and experience other cultures, other areas, even if it's a matter of going to small town USA and really trying to understand, like, who are these people?
Yeah, I mean, you can get a lot just by going a couple hours upstate and seeing people in a small town upstate New York. It's another world. So I want to understand, though, the way, I know you said you went to boarding school, but up until that time, in Des Moines, where you were going to school, were other kids, were your friends, their families similar to yours?
No.
With a traditional?
No.
No? What were they like?
I mean, my mother was definitely the only one that worked. I mean, when I grew up, like, all the other kids that I was in school with, their parents were just housewives. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you'd go home mm-hmm. from school and they'd be making you cookies. Mm-hmm. You know, we had, like, you know, a housekeeper that would pick me up after school, and everybody thought she was my mom.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. So your mom was pretty radical in a lot of ways.
She was definitely, you know, and it was hard because I know that she was really working hard to run the business with my dad. And, you know, it became, like, standard. If it was up to my mom to pick us up after school, for example, we'd be waiting for, like, hours, like, just sitting on the curb for, like, 2 hours waiting for her to pick us up because she would get stuck at work. And, mm-hmm. you know, this is, like, a daily reality that we dealt with growing up as little kids.
That's hard.
And we had to, you know, we sort of kept ourselves busy with mm-hmm. a lot of, like, after school programs and, like, studying mm-hmm. after mm-hmm. class and whatnot, because that was the only way that she could, like, manage us.
And was your brother, are they pretty traditional male, female role type people?
No, not at all.
No,
we're all pretty eccentric.
Okay, so do they, you're all weirdos. So do your brothers have, like, pretty enlightened wives and stuff like that? Or are they married and stuff like that?
I have one brother who lives in LA. He's an animation director, tech, sort of computer whiz. You know, was one of the producers for, like, PlayStation 2, and he worked on Narnia, and like, does very high tech sort of mm-hmm. digital work. And his wife is was a feature film producer. She worked on, like, a ton of movies. They actually met on the set of the film Babe, the pig movie that won an Oscar. They were both working on the movie Babe. So
it takes a romantic.
Yeah, exactly. But in any case, so yeah, she actually unfortunately had breast cancer and sort of, like, transitioned her career after that to, you know, less demanding career. But he's a very cool guy, very creative. And I have another brother who's a TV editor. He does, like, mm-hmm. you know, edits for, like, Shark Tank and stuff like that.
So you have, you know, so your family is, they're very modern.
Yeah.
Or, like,
definitely.
So I want to understand how, so I understand. So that's interesting. And I want to understand how that translates. Like, where did your interest in the body and the female body and all that come about? Like,
so, you know, after working as a fashion photographer and in that sector for a long time, you know, I had always also been working as an artist. I'm just very drawn, A, to figurative work that addresses the female body, because feminism really is about body politics. And a lot of feminist issues are related directly to the female body. It all makes sense to most feminist artists. I would say 99% are figurative, because at the end of the day, that, you know, dialogue really resonates with like the interpretation and visual. It's like representation of women in society, right? And mm-hmm. like how women are dealt with in society, like feminist art is directly related to that. So, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, A, coming from a background that I've come from, B, like my interest in feminist studies and whatnot, it all sort of comes together and makes sense to be mm-hmm. very focused.
Right. Cause you have all that feminist studies,
exactly.
Education. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and like, I'm wondering about, like, for you, like, you know, like, do you feel that women are judged really harshly on their bodies? Is it something, I mean, your sister's a dancer. Is it something that's affected you? Or,
I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the things that we really address in our current exhibit, Body Beautiful, is like the contemporary notion of beauty standards and how the body positive movement has become so important, mm-hmm. which really challenges, you know, beauty standards and like the idea of fat shaming and skinny shaming and people like, you know, feeling like they're not beautiful if they don't cover up their scars with makeup mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. if they, you know, whatever it is that, mm-hmm. you know, because every single mm-hmm. human has like, it's the nature of being human is that we all have flaws of some mm-hmm. component. Like there's, unless you're a newborn infant, it's highly unlikely that you're like in always like, you know, a component of perfection. I mean, mm-hmm. it is what it is. Like as you evolve and get older, everybody deals with their own bodily issues and their own insecurities. And part of that movement is also about, you know, self-esteem and feeling, you know, like it's okay accepting yourself mm-hmm. for who you are and mm-hmm. feeling beautiful no matter how you look. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. Mm-hmm. I think that the emphasis on like traditional beauty is way overemphasized. And I think it's really great mm-hmm. that right now we're seeing a lot mm-hmm. more emphasis on diversity, mm-hmm. on people with flaws, on it's okay to show that you've got mm-hmm. bad skin. You don't have to retouch that pimple when you post it mm-hmm. on Facebook. I actually don't retouch any of my photos when I post
really?
Them. I don't. And I think I don't use any of those little apps. I try to avoid it. I mean, granted, mm-hmm. if you're being photographed like with a good photographer mm-hmm. with a flash on their camera, they're going to make you look good anyway. But I personally don't like to use any of those transforming mm-hmm. apps when I post on social media or whatnot, mm-hmm. because I think it's like, it is what it is. Like, mm-hmm. you know, do I really need to make myself look skinnier? Like, what's the point? Like, it would just mm-hmm. be yourself.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, I respect, you know, I respect, this is not men and no disrespect at all. But I, you know, you are, you know, you're a good looking woman. And I find it like, do other women, like how do women, like, so you are a genuine champion of the body positivity movement. You're authentic. I'm not, you know, questioning that. But how do other artists or how do people react to you in the sense that you're championing all these different looks, but what you have is socially the kind of
traditional look,
good gold standard-ish.
I mean, you know, that's it. Listen, at the end of the day, I mean, I'm over 40. All right. Mm-hmm. I personally don't think that I am like, you know, everybody has their own sense of self-esteem. I don't think I'm the most drop-dead gorgeous person on the planet. Like, I personally, like, do my best, you know?
Right, but, right.
I mean, I've gone through a lot of ups and downs in my life with my body weight, with how my self-esteem, with all kinds of things, you
I'm
know?
Wondering if you have felt a lot of pressure about your, I mean, your... I mean, we're not talking about whether you're attractive or not attractive, but you being in the beauty business and stuff like that. I mean, I'm just saying, like, is there, are you, do you have some, like, you know, rebellion against being involved with all that or seeing that or?
No, I mean, I feel like, to be very honest with you, also, when I was a photographer, I really had to play down how I looked. I really, I wore like really ugly baggy trousers and like, you know, flat like shoes that were like boots and like couldn't feel, I never felt like I could work and be feminine or be, and I actually really, when I started working on my own, doing my own magazine and doing my own stuff, my own artwork, I was like really happy that for once I could dress up and be feminine and wear heels if I wanted to, because as a photographer, I had to really play it down. No makeup, hair in a ponytail, sneakers, because you're like working your ass off and you certainly can't show up on set wearing high heels. Like, you know, that was just not allowed. So I think, you know, well, it's not that it wasn't allowed. It would be totally inappropriate to be a photographer showing up on set where you're expected to be like managing all this camera equipment. And my camera itself weighs like 20 kilos or something crazy. It's a big medium format thing. And, you know, to be sitting there like running a set with all these assistants and crew and everybody's in like grip outfits, you know, crew, you know, like people really dressed down on set, in case you've ever noticed. In any case, you know, if you saw behind the scenes pictures of me as a photographer when I was like working full time in that, in that sector, people would probably be like, I can't believe that's the same person. But I actually, you know, this is me, how I am now. And I feel like I always wanted and felt feminine and wanted to be able to like dress up and wear heels or wear makeup. And I couldn't do that when I was working as a photographer. I had to dress it down and really kind of play down my looks, because it wasn't about my looks. It was about the model I was photographing.
And you had to run around. And you clearly, I want to make this clear, folks, she clearly enjoys fashion. It's not like you're just all about, you know, how do I look? You enjoy clothes. You probably enjoy picking out clothes and putting looks together and all.
I mean,
it's an outlet. It's an out. I think it's an outlet for you. It's not just.
I mean, I think I don't really necessarily put looks together, but I think I have an eye for fashion because I worked in the industry for a long time. I have I've worked very closely with a lot of fashion designers, and I often, you know, wear designers that I like, you know. I mean, I know the industry. I've probably seen in my lifetime over 1,000 fashion shows. So you kind of get like a little bit of an eye for what you like. And, you know, honestly, a lot of people send me free clothes.
Oh, so I might as well wear them. Good. If you ever, let me know. well, I'll have to borrow something next time I have an occasion. But anyway, never mind. So the thing is also a lot of, I talk about, I like to talk about sexual currency. I always find that, I've talked about that before, because I always find that such an interesting topic in the sense that how women, women can manipulate men and get things based on their looks and how they use their looks. And there seems to be the problem I have. I mean, I don't, it's great. But on the other hand, I think that women also undermine being taken seriously when they do that sometimes. Like, how do you have a sense of that? Have you thought about that?
I mean, I personally don't really try to use or manipulate others because, you know, I think it's really important to just like, I don't know. I mean, I think that there is a sexual currency and some women do, you know, use their looks to get ahead or whatever, but that's never really been. And in the industry I'm in, it really wouldn't work, you know, like there's just not really like, what am I going to do? Like I work with a lot of women, like I'm surrounded by women 24/7, like the feminist movement is almost all women, you know, like you're not going to really get much traction being like that with other women. Right. In fact, it's going to hurt you more than help you. In fact, I've found in general the way that I look often is a negative. I feel like people make assumptions about me that are not necessarily correct. And I think that it can also, sometimes people are intimidated for some bizarre reason. And I sometimes don't understand why. But then, you know, and then I see other artists that are gorgeous and make an effort. And I'm like, well, nobody seems bothered by it, by them. So what's the issue?
You know, it's funny. Like, there's two kinds of women. I was thinking about this. You go in the cat to me, you're in the category. Like when I was younger and I would get catcalled, there are two kinds of women. The women that I imagine men, like I used to think, well, that woman wouldn't get catcalled because men are intimidated by that woman, or they are, you know, they're not going to do that. And I'm, you know, whatever the crazy person I am, and I get catcalled. Do you know what I mean? Did you ever get catcalled? Do you get catcalled as much as ever?
Occasionally. Honestly, I've always had this sort of, when I'm on the street or whatnot, just like very much like a horse with blinders on, just like, you know, focus on my own thing. Don't get bothered by other people. Mm-hmm. I think that that's like a mentality I've always kind of tried to like avoid getting distracted.
Right.
And I think that the whole catcalling thing, I mean, for sure, everybody's experienced that at some stage. I try not to get offended by it. I just sort of like ignore it, but I don't see the point in even like trying to let that like penetrate my emotional state.
So maybe part of what you're projecting is a certain groundedness, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think also
you're kind of unflappable.
I think there's a component of like making a decision, like what are you going to let affect your life? Do you let these little things affect you, or do you focus on more important things? And I try to prioritize like what is really important and try not to get bogged down by the little things. If I put my blinders on to, you know, and at the end of the day, like running my business, there's a constant like headache of managing the team. My tiny little, like I have, you know, like I said, an internship program where it's like a school credit or like a small daily stipends program, or basically like I'm kind of running the whole show myself. And then I have a little bit of help occasionally with part-time people that come in. And that can often be frustrating because people can be like sort of have like different expectations or expect a lot of, how can we put it? Like expect a lot of hand-holding or et cetera. And I just, instead of getting like freaked out and offended every time something goes wrong, I really have to just focus on like, what are my priorities? What are my goals? What am I trying to do? How am I trying to make a difference? I'm not going to let every single person's like emotional state and their own insecurities or their own issues or the catcallers of the world like affect my goals. I need to, you know, and I think it's just really important to prioritize, focus on the goal. And that's what I do. I have like, you know, you really have to just, I guess then that's the point of what you said. I'm an overachiever, which I don't know. I just do what seems natural to me. And sometimes maybe take on too much, which can be an issue. But at the end of the day, I think that if I'm inspired to do something, I do it. And if I agree to do something, I put 100% into making sure that I do a good job. Like I like to do things halfway.
Right. Yeah. I get that feeling about you. You also have a lot of physical energy, I think. Right.
I mean, I probably get 8 or 9 hours of sleep a night.
Were you athletic as a kid?
I ran track and, I was actually very good at running. I wasn't that into sports though. But I was on like the, you know, I played tennis and sort of a few we had mandatory sports in school, but I wasn't really that into it. I wasn't on any teams in high school or anything. As a little kid, I did the track team.
So you were physically engaged, but not necessarily like a sports person. But I think that's really important actually, is to have like, I think growing up, I would push sports on girls now. I think it's really important. I think it's really important to be physically, you know, active. I think it really helps you mentally.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I definitely go to the gym and whatnot. I was never really that interested in like team sports. I kind of just like to do my own thing. I mean, at one stage, like when I was in high school, I did like horseback riding and stuff because, you know, you just did your own thing. It wasn't like a team sport.
So how do you get all this stuff done? I mean, do you think your mom set an example? Did you learn a lot? She must have, you know, been able to accomplish. She obviously accomplished a lot. So was it like watching her, or like, how are you super organized? How the fuck do you do it? How the fuck? Right. How do I get some? No, how do you do it?
So I think a big component, like people need to a couple of things before I even go into like my day to day of how I do it. I think we need to take a couple of things into consideration. Like, I've done all of this in stages, right? So I started out working on my own as an artist and photographer and did that exclusively for 15 years. Mm-hmm. Then I spent another 5 years developing my magazine and focused just on my magazine. And I was still like occasionally working on my art and photography, but I was really focused on magazine developing that. After about 5 years, the company gets to a stage and the magazine gets to a stage where it's established enough where it almost will run on its own. You have contributors established mm-hmm. and people mm-hmm. working with you, and it just kind of like evolves and takes its own mm-hmm. sort of direction. And then I launched the gallery, and, you know, I've now, it's our 5th anniversary in January of the gallery. So the gallery has also kind of become its own animal and has its own flow. And there's a lot of artists we've worked with for many years already that are working with us. And I think that there's just that component of like, you can take on more stuff. Once you've established one thing, you can add another thing to your plate. Mm-hmm. Equally, I am extremely organized. I like live by Excel spreadsheets, like Google Docs, whatever. I mean,
really?
I literally everything, all of my product, you have to remember, I also have, after I graduated college, like while I was working as a photographer, I did, post-grad like film studies, for directing and film producing. And, you know, you really learn when you study film production and film producing, like how to work on like massive productions, how to break them down, you know, how to plan out your budgets and team mm-hmm. and et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I think that having also that film background and producing background,
right.
I can sit down and I can produce events. The photography and the filmmaking mm-hmm. background has really assist me with being super organized with regards to production mm-hmm. and producing, and a lot mm-hmm. of running a magazine, running your own studio as an artist, running a gallery is all about production. It's really about figuring out what needs to get done. What is my timeline to do it? You know, how much staff do I need? How much budget do I need? How can I allocate this? And then you just focus on like having a final goal
wow.
and like the timeline that required to do that.
Well, my head is spinning hearing about that. It works for you.
You know, it's breaking it down. I think that for every artist, one thing I think, you know, or for every person, like if you have a big goal, don't just try to swallow it whole. That doesn't work. You need to break it down.
Right.
So figure it out, break it down, say, okay, so this is how I need to get started. Like, why don't just start with like building an outline? Mm-hmm. That's one thing that I learned at college, like do your outline first, like, and that way you can break it down your whole project. And then work one by the other at a time to get it done, because it's unrealistic to just try to do it all at once. You have to break it down.
Right. So there was one more thing I wanted to ask you, and then I want to talk about the foundation that you work. But there was one other thing I wanted to ask you, and I lost my train of thought. Damn it.
Totally overwhelmed. Too much going on. I mean,
it's
my
just
state.
Like looking.
Listen,
yeah,
that's
listen.
My state.
Oh, this is what I wanted to ask you. Fun. Like, do you have any recreational time? Do you ever not? Are you ever not working? Are you ever like, do you go out to dinner with a friend? Do you go to the movies? Is there any of that? That's
of course.
What I want to know.
I mean, I try to make time, you know, for myself. Like, I, you know, you can only work a certain amount of hours every day. That's really important to me to get, you know, 8-9 hours of sleep. I need my sleep. That's one thing I know.
Mm-hmm.
I really have low patience if I haven't slept enough. And in the evenings, you know, after work, I try to, you know, hang out with my boyfriend or go to movies with friends. I have a lot of friends.
That's good. And you have a lot of friends.
I have a lot of friends who are also writers and or artists. And it's really important for me to be around other creative people. So it's nice to just connect and like, you know, do things after hours.
So you were able to do that too.
Oh, yeah. Like tonight I'm going to a film screening with a girlfriend of mine who is a journalist. So we're going to go see the new Bombshell movie with Charlize Theron. So,
wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
See? Wow. Okay, outlines. I think that's a good idea. You know, that actually makes a lot of sense. I think I'm going to think about that. So we only have 6 minutes left, which isn't a lot. And I think just to get this all down, I want to make sure that I tell everybody like how they can find you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go through the details for the Body Beautiful exhibit again. And then I want to talk about this new project that you've just started, Art for equality. Okay, so let's get through the details first. Okay, first of all, why don't you say where, your website and all that stuff.
All right.
Spell your name.
So you can check out my personal work on my website, Indira Cesarine, which is IndiraCesarine.com. All my social media is also Indira Cesarine. I keep it simple. As far as the gallery, the Untitled Space, we're located at 45 Lispinard Street in Tribeca. Our current show, Body Beautiful, is on until December 20th. Next week on Wednesday and Thursday, we're planning a collaboration with Woman Boss, which is super cool.
Oh, that's cool.
Fashion, beauty, retail, all female entrepreneurs. And we're going to be doing like a little shopping event at the gallery on Wednesday and Thursday where people can come and buy art and jewelry or whatever little presents they want for the holidays.
Ooh.
Yeah. So that'll be a little fun thing to do before we shut down. We pretty much close the gallery from December 21st until after the new year.
Good. Are you going anywhere?
I'm actually going to visit my mother in California.
Oh, nice. Good for you. Yeah. And I also want to remind people, too, that, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and to make sure that you check out our fundraising campaign online, okay? So go to radiofreebrooklyn.org, and we're calling it the Drive to Five campaign. So it's serious shit, folks. We need to really, a lot of people, we're doing a lot of great stuff, and we want to stick around, so make sure check it out, all right? I'm not going to go through that spiel again. It's too boring. So tell us about Art for Equity.
Art for Equality. So basically, I realized in my whole sort of mission to launch the Untitled Space, which focuses heavily on female artists, we represent all female artists, and our group shows are about 80% women, 20% men. I've been doing the gallery now for 5 years, and I really realized that in order to make an impact, to really make a difference, I couldn't do it on my own. I needed to be able to reach out and get help, get funding, be able to raise money, be able to, get more people on board, more support on board. So I launched my initiative, Art for Equality, this past November. And basically it's raising funds for gender equality themed art exhibits and public art. The facts are pretty astounding when you really look at, for example, even public art in New York City alone. Okay, I'll use that to cite one little example of women compared to men and the issues that we have right now in the art world. Of 150 statues currently in New York City, only 5 represent women. And so isn't this incredible?
Yes. Are you kidding me?
Right, let me pull this up. Hang on.
Kidding?
So, yeah, it's a very, very low statistic. It's all the rest are men, right? So basically the New York government has now allocated funding for another 4 statues to be added, which will bring up the total percentage to 6% female.
Wow.
Right. So that's pretty astounding. Only 2 works of by women have ever broken the top 100 auction sales for paintings.
Wow.
Despite women being the subject matter of approximately half of the 25.
Wow.
The other statistic that I think is pretty phenomenal is just that as far as representation of women in galleries and museums, it's at 13%. So out of 13.7% of living female artists are represented by galleries in Europe and North America. All these statistics are available and visible to view. And that's out of 50% women graduating from art school and from graduate school with masters in art. So, we have a 50% demographic of women graduating, but the percentage of those women that will actually get gallery representation is only 13%, out of the, everyone. So, all of this really adds up, and I launched Art for Equality to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And you can visit us at artforequality4.org and learn more about it. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, That's eventually great. Hear more about our exhibits and our plans and our fundraising.
I really want to thank you for all that you do on behalf of women. I'm saying this for a lot of women. I think it's really, really valuable what you're doing. And I personally appreciate it. And I'm saying that, I think, on behalf of my listeners. So anyway, thanks so much for sharing that with us and being here today. And it's very, very interesting. And I want you guys to stick around, because We've got great.
Dr. Lisa gives a shit. Dr. Lisa gives a shit.